The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. On Monday morning, June 15th, 1215, King John met with his barons in the meadow of Runnymede and affixed his royal seal on the Great Charter. That charter is best known today by its Latin name, the Magna Carta. Today, the Magna Carta is 800 years old. You look back on some of the history leading up to it. King John, of course, was a notorious tyrant who was abusing his powers at home and losing battles abroad. Britain was facing the threat of a possible invasion from France. And in London, many of King John's barons were in open rebellion against the king's blatantly lawless behavior. And so, rather than lose the nation, the king submitted to the barons' demands and affixed his seal on what many now believe to be the greatest constitutional document in history. With the Magna Carta in place on June 15th, 1215, King John was officially beneath the law. And that is the fundamental principle of the Great Charter, rule of law. No one is above the law, not even the king. As Daniel Hannan wrote, what the Great Charter enshrined in statutory form was that the supreme power in the land was not the executive, but a set of fixed legal principles, and that in any clash between the two, the law would prevail over the government. On June 15, 1215, in a meadow near Windsor Castle, the law stood above the government. The law, as Mr. Hannan wrote, the law prevailed. And what a turning point this was for Britain. What a turning point it was for the world. In many ways, you could say what happened at Runnymede 800 years ago today, that it laid the foundation for the British Empire and also the American superpower. Notice what Winston Churchill wrote in his famous work, A History of the English-Speaking Peoples. He said, if the 13th century magnates understood little and cared less for the popular liberties or parliamentary democracy, they had all the same laid hold of a principle which was to be of prime importance for the future development of English society and English institutions. Throughout the document, it is implied that here is a law which is above the king and which even he must not break. This reaffirmation of a supreme law and its expression in a general charter is the great work of Magna Carta. And this alone justifies the respect in which men have held it. The reign of Henry II, according to the most respected authorities, initiates the rule of law. But the work as yet was incomplete. The crown was still above the law. The legal system which Henry had created could become, as John showed, an instrument of oppression. Now, for the first time, the king himself is bound by the law. Churchill says the root principle was destined to survive across the generations and rise paramount long after the feudal background of 1215 had faded in the past. That's from Churchill's work, A History of the English-Speaking Peoples. And that root principle that he spoke of, that root principle of the Magna Carta, it not only survived in Britain, it thrived, and later it was exported to North America. You look at that history, And far from rejecting the principles of the Magna Carta, the founding documents of the U.S., they show that the Americans were embracing that great English charter. Many of the early Americans viewed King George III as a tyrant who had put himself above the law. In their minds, the Magna Carta wasn't the problem, it was the solution. Look at this example, 1766, when Parliament asked Benjamin Franklin, on what basis do you call for the Stamp Act to be repealed? And Franklin said the colonists could not be taxed without common consent, as declared in the Magna Carta. You look at that history, early American history, and you can see why many historians have even compared America's founding fathers to those barons at Runnymede who insisted that King John subject himself to the rule of law. 2 weeks ago, I had the opportunity to see the Magna Carta exhibit at the British Library in London. And they had on display two of the four original 1215 Magna Carta documents. They were written in Latin, so you can't very well read along like you can with some of the founding documents in America. But to see those two documents, and then this exhibit had Thomas Jefferson's handwritten copy of the Declaration of Independence. How fascinating it was to look at that, to view that document, and to see the words that Jefferson himself underlined or capitalized or emphasized in a certain way. They also had one of the original copies of the U.S. Bill of Rights on display there in London. And together with those documents, all kinds of other stunning artifacts and manuscripts, paintings, statues. And it all brought the history to life. And I think the museum did an excellent job of showing the continuity of thought that runs from the Magna Carta right through the subsequent twists and turns in English history, and then right into the many different charters and constitutions of the original American colonies. And of course, eventually, right into the Constitution of the United States itself. Two brother nations, bound by the rule of law, blessed by Almighty God. It was an inspiring exhibit. Definitely worth seeing if you're here in the UK region. The exhibit, by the way, also highlighted the Vatican's strong opposition to the Magna Carta, which is interesting, isn't it? Pope Innocent III immediately declared the charter null and void, of all validity forever. And in that exhibit, there was also a picture of Oliver Cromwell holding up the Magna Carta with his boot right on the throat of a great whore, which, as you probably know, the Bible uses to typify a great false church. That exhibit, as I say, it brought the history to life. It's going to be on display there at the British Library until September the 1st. As I say, I highly recommend it if you happen to live in the UK region. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. The live stream is available at kpcg.fm. You can email us at td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Can you imagine a world without famine, disease, and pestilence? A world free of crime, war, and hatred? Man has tried throughout history to rid the world of these problems, but to no avail. Will man ever find the way to peace? The Bible speaks of a soon coming utopia, in which God will finally bring us peace. It will be a world governed by God's law of love. Poverty, famine, illiteracy, and escalating violence will be reversed. The dry and barren lands of the world will be made fertile, and resources will be plenteous. Sickness and disease will be replaced by robust and prosperous living. The language barrier will be bridged, and an education in the true values of life will flourish the world over. Beyond this bleak, unhappy, present-day reality is this soon-coming future. Our booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, is free at our website, thetrumpet.com. Download it or request it free today.
You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.
I think King John would have been surprised that the charter he sealed at Runnymede 800 years ago has become such a powerful and influential document. It was one of many charters around at the time. It was annulled within a couple of months because it had been extracted by duress. Only a few sentences from it remain on the statute book. But because of what it stands for, it is important. The themes that we have derived from it, perhaps even read into it, are so fundamental that I think we're right and fully entitled to be celebrating it today.
That was legal commentator Joshua Rosenberg commenting on the influence of the Magna Carta. And of course, that influence has been so strong, in particular in Britain, of course, and also the United States. These two, Britain and America, have been two of the world's freest, most democratic countries. And for centuries, they've stood out from other nations for their rule of law, for their concepts of justice, and for their protections of liberty. I quoted Daniel Hannan before the break. And in his book, Inventing Freedom, How the English-Speaking Peoples Made the Modern World, he quotes a Texan jurist who said in 1937, "There is a straight road which runs from Runnymede to Philadelphia. We did not borrow provisions from the British Constitution, which had come from the people. Those provisions were ours, paid for with the lives of our ancestors on many a battlefield. I have examined the matter," he said. "I tell you, our Constitution came up from the body of a self-governing people, but we can lose our capacity to govern by its non-exercise. We can lose these precious liberties if we don't uphold the rule of law." The Magna Carta, or the Declaration of Independence, the American Constitution, I mean, these have been the foundational documents of the Anglo-dominated world for the past 2.5 centuries. But now look at our nations today. The sun's already set on the British Empire. And you see the United States right now transitioning through this breathtaking decline. And like never before, we see the rule of law in our nations undermined, attacked, ridiculed, maligned in every possible way. Do you suppose there is any connection between these two developments, our decline, and also the lawless spirit of our very modern society? Let me read to you what Paul Johnson wrote. This was back in 1999. I quoted this from this last week. Famous historian. He says, "The essence of the rule of law is its impersonality, omnipotence, and ubiquity. It's the same law for everyone, everywhere. Kings, emperors, high priests, the state itself are subject to it." He says, "If exceptions are made, the rule of law begins to collapse. That was the grand lesson of antiquity. That's been the lesson of history. If you start making exceptions, well, then the whole system collapses. That's what we're seeing in our society. One exception after another. At thespectator.co.uk, there was a recent headline that said, "We're celebrating Magna Carta's anniversary by making it obsolete." That's what we're doing in Britain, that particular commentator was saying. He quoted a recent speech given by Christopher Gill, who said, "What an irony it is that in this very year in which we might well have been celebrating the 200th anniversary of the defeat of the 19th century manifestation of continental totalitarianism, the focus will instead be upon the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta, the fundamental tenets of which this government has so recently, deliberately, and gratuitously trashed." That's Britain today. And it's not any better in the United States. As you see, those liberties that are there because of the rule of law under attack. You see those liberties disappearing. This is from Victor Davis Hanson, Building the New Dark Age Mind. It's from June 10th. He writes, "An American could speak his mind more freely in 1970 than now." You think those freedoms, is it something that you're taking for granted? That those freedoms, those liberties will always be there? Well, look around you. Open your eyes and see what's being taken away, see what's disappearing. He says an American could speak his mind more freely in 1970 than now. Many, he goes on and says, many in the United States had naively believed that the Enlightenment, the U.S. Constitution, and over two centuries of American customs and traditions had guaranteed that Americans could always take for granted free speech and unfettered inquiry. It would always be there, he says. But that is an ahistorical assumption. The wish to silence, censor, and impede thought is just as strong a human emotion as the desire for free expression, especially when censorship is cloaked in rhetoric about fairness, equality, justice, and all the other euphemisms for not allowing the free promulgation of ideas. See, in American society, we hear a lot about fairness and equality and justice. And yet, look at the crime and the violence and the lawlessness that is increasing, that's multiplying. Hanson says George Orwell devoted his later years to warning us that while the fascist method of destroying free expression was easily identified, albeit only with difficulty combated, the left-wing totalitarian impulse to squelch unpopular speech was far harder to resist. It's hard to resist. You see it creeping into our society. Look at the respect and the reverence for law and how it's devolved at every level of society. Today, we're in grave danger of losing our freedoms, of losing them without even putting up a fight. Let's go to Matthew 23, get your Bible and read along with me. I want to cover some history here that happened in the church that we came out from, a church that's been destroyed because of lawlessness. We saw it play out on the spiritual level, and now it's unfolding in the nations of Ephraim and Manasseh, their modern descendants, Britain and America. Let me just finish this quote from Victor Davis Hanson. He says, "In our current dark age, logic is ignored in lieu of ideology. The country's terrified about having a rational and logical discussion about almost every great issue of our times, unsustainable national debts and deficits, the new nexus between left-wing plutocracy and populism, the viability of Social Security and Medicare, deteriorating race relations, the Soviet-style American campus, global warming, and the deterioration of medical care." It says, instead to preclude honest talk, We offer perfunctory charges of sexism and racism and seek cover in fairness, quote-unquote, and equality, quote-unquote. Finally, he concludes, this descent into the Dark Ages will not end well. It never has in the past. Here again, just like Paul Johnson said, this has been the lesson of history. You keep making exceptions, and the rule of law begins to collapse. That's the grand lesson. Or, to put it the way Mr. Hansen does, this descent into the Dark Ages will not end well. It never has in the past. Now look at what it says here in Matthew 23. Verse 23 says, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought you to have done and not to leave the other undone. See, what about the weightier matters of the law? These Pharisees had gotten caught up into twiggier issues, important issues, but they were doing away with the weightier issues. Judgment, mercy, faith. In Herbert Armstrong's booklet, What is Faith? He said, every particle of human suffering, unhappiness, misery, and death has come solely from its transgression, the law's transgression. All the suffering, the unhappiness, you see a lot of it in the world today. Well, I'm talking here about a destruction, an abomination that happened within a church because of lawlessness. You compare what Mr. Armstrong said in that booklet, every particle of human suffering, unhappiness, misery, it comes from transgressing God's law. Now you compare that with what his successor said in 1992, Joseph de Koch, he said, it's a common mistake to assume if everybody would just keep the Ten Commandments, what a nice world we would have. Christians should consider that the Ten Commandments do not require kindness. Think about this. It's delusional. The Ten Commandments do not require kindness, mercy, compassion, generosity, sacrifice for others, impartiality, patience, or love. Nor do the Ten Commandments specifically forbid conceit, envy, hatred, rage, or selfish ambition. That's unbelievable. I mean, that was said just 5 or 6 years after Herbert Armstrong died. It was an attack on God's law. 1 John 5 and verse 3 says, For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments. That's how you love God. Obedience to his laws, the rule of law, upholding the rule of law. Well, even in that statement in Matthew 23, Jesus said one of the weightier matters of the law is mercy. And yet Mr. de Koch came along in 1992 and said, the Ten Commandments don't require mercy. Where did that spirit of hostility toward God's law come from? Where is that same spirit that we see in society today? Where is it coming from? Continuing in verse 27, it says, woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. I'm reading from the King James Version. For you are like unto whited sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous unto men, but within you are full of hypocrisy and iniquity. Now, Mr. de Koch quoted those two verses, and he inserted teachers of the law. Woe unto you, teachers of the law, as if teaching the law is wrong. But you look at the Greek manuscript, and it doesn't say that. It says what I just said to you from the King James. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! But Mr. de Koch looked and looked and looked for some kind of translation that would say teachers of the law, because he wanted to criticize the law. He wanted to undermine God's law. And we see that same spirit in society today. Last week I mentioned the division that it caused the United States, or in the United States, back in 1987, when Ronald Reagan nominated Robert Bork to the Supreme Court. And, of course, that was rejected in Congress. And years later, on the Larry King Live, this was in 2005, I believe, Mr. Bork was asked, well, what is it that makes a good Supreme Court judge? And he said during that interview, a willingness to apply the Constitution according to the principles that are actually in it, rather than what they call the evolving or the living Constitution, which simply means the judges begin to make it up. See, there's a lot of proponents today supporting the evolving Constitution. And all that that amounts to is just making things up along the way, according to human reasoning. Mr. Bork said, in a constitutional democracy, the moral content of law must be given by the morality of the framer or the legislator, never by the morality of the judge. I mean, you've got to go back to the original intent. You've got to go back to the framer. You've got to go back to the lawgiver, whether you look at it spiritually or in the physical national sense. Either way, whether you look at it with respect to the Bible or the Constitution. And, of course, the Constitution itself, as was the Magna Carta. They were based on biblical principles in so many ways. Not perfect documents, but nevertheless, you have framers or founders that really did draw up these documents based on Bible principles. Mr. Bork in that interview said, those who made and endorsed our Constitution knew, those who made and endorsed our Constitution knew man's nature. And it is to their ideas, rather than to the temptations of utopia, that we must ask that our judges adhere. See, they understood and knew about man's nature. They had an understanding of what's clearly stated in Jeremiah 17 and verse 9, or Romans 8 and verse 7. Look it up yourself. See what God says about the heart within man. See what God says about our natural tendencies. And it's worse today. And it's getting worse by the day. Because you have these workers of iniquity, as I say, attacking the law, attacking God's standard, attacking the Constitution, attacking the principles of the Magna Carta, trashing it, as that one quote brought out. Again, you look at that history in the 1980s, whether it's with the Worldwide Church of God after Mr. Armstrong died, or with what was happening right in the United States with Mr. Bork's nomination. I mean, here is this man, a former Marine, a law graduate from the University of Chicago, a professor at Yale Law School. He served as the U.S. Solicitor General, as acting Attorney General. He was a Court of Appeals judge. When he was confirmed by the Senate as the appellate judge, in 1982, the American Bar Association said that he was exceptionally well qualified. I mean, it gave him the highest rating. And then in 1987, when one of the Supreme Court justices stepped down, that's when President Reagan announced his intention to nominate Mr. Bork. And that set off a red-hot controversy in Washington, D.C. within 45 minutes. Of that announcement by the president. You had senators on the left denouncing this nominee on national TV. And so the confirmation hearings began. I think it was back in September of 1987. And it didn't go well for Mr. Bork. His nomination was rejected. by the Senate's Judiciary Committee, 9-5. And that pretty much sealed his fate. And yet, Mr. Bork, to his credit, he refused to withdraw, even though everyone knew he was going to lose. He stayed the course. And on October 10th, 1987, he gave a statement at the White House saying this: "In the 100 days since my nomination, the country has witnessed an unprecedented event. The process of confirming justices for our nation's highest court has been transformed in a way that should not and indeed must not be permitted to occur again. The tactics and techniques of national political campaigns have been unleashed on the process of confirming judges. That's not simply disturbing, it's dangerous. Federal judges are not appointed to decide cases according to the latest opinion polls. They're appointed to decide cases impartially according to the law. But when judicial nominees are assessed and treated like political candidates, the effect will be to chill the climate in which judicial deliberations take place, to erode public confidence in the impartiality of courts, and to endanger the independence of the judiciary." He says, finally, "In 200 years, no nominee for justice has ever campaigned for that high office. None ever should, and I will not." He stayed the course, but he did not campaign. The fact is, those on the far left hated the idea of him being confirmed to the court because he was all about original intent. He was all about rule of law. And this is hated on the left. It's hated in academia. It's hated in the media. It's hated in society because of that built-in hostility toward God's law. Let's look at Habakkuk chapter 1. Just go through one more passage here before we conclude. Habakkuk 1. And here again, we'll draw some parallels between what's happening in the United States, in Britain, with what happened in the Worldwide Church of God back in the late 1980s, in the early 1990s. Again, the situation here, whether you look at it spiritually or physically, nationally, it's made worse by the fact that we're living in the last days. And as Revelation 12 brings out, Satan has been cast down. Satan and his demons are confined to this earth. And they're behind the spirit of lawlessness. Habakkuk 1, verse 1, it says, "The burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see, O Lord, how long shall I cry, and you will not hear, even cry out unto you of violence, and you will not save?" How long? I mean, he was crying out for God to intervene. There was a temple crisis in Habakkuk's day, and he wanted God to intervene and to make judgment. Verse 3, "Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to behold grievance? For spoiling and violence are before me, and there are that raise up strife and contention." As my father's brought out before, these words, strife and contention, it's talking about a great legal struggle and how God's faithful people, well, they didn't fare well in this legal struggle because of unjust rulers who rose above the law, who put themselves ahead of God's law or the law of the land. Verse 4 says, "Therefore the law is slacked, and judgment does never go forth, for the wicked does compass about the righteous. Therefore, wrong judgment proceeds." See, when the wicked compass about the righteous, that's what you're left with, wrong judgment. And that word judgment, by the way, means verdict or a sentence or formal decree. There's not many righteous verdicts left in our land. One final verse in Judges, the book of Judges. Again, you look at the history with ancient Israel, and you see what they were going through. They're at the end of Joshua's rule, and the beginning of the judges period. It wasn't pretty. Let me just quote to you as you turn over there, if you have your Bible. This is from my father's booklet, the booklet America Under Attack, from chapter 1, The Hidden Cause of Society's Deadly Decline. And in this chapter, he's really drawing, again, the parallels between what happened to a church in the late 1980s and early 1990s and what happens or is happening in our nations. He talks about what changed in 1986. The devil was cast down to earth and began his lawless rampage. I saw with my own eyes the damage he wreaked on God's church. Now it's becoming ever clearer that he's unleashing the same kind of destruction on our nations. Look, we can look at the nations today and see where this is headed. Those of us that lived through what happened to the Worldwide Church of God in the early 1990s, we can see where this is headed. It was shocking to us just how fast the transformation happened. A fundamental transformation in the Worldwide Church of God. And it happened within just months, within just a few short years. And what we were left with was a church that people could hardly recognize. He says the only difference is this: the destruction in God's church was on the spiritual level, and the three nations are being destroyed on a letter of the law level because they don't yet have God's Holy Spirit. This will, however, lead to these nations being conquered from without. Three nations. He is talking also about Judah. So Judah, Ephraim, and Manasseh, or the little nation of Israel in the Middle East, Britain, what was Great Britain, and the United States of America. Judges 17 and verse 6, it says, in those days there was no king in Israel, but every man did that which was right in his own eyes. My father makes a powerful point in his booklet, No Freedom Without Law, when he says you can find Israel today just by looking at this verse, just by understanding this history with ancient Israel. Where are those lost tribes? Where are those lost tribes that were taken into captivity in the 700s BC, taken into Assyrian captivity and lost from worldview? Where did they go? Or is it just the Jews that are left today? What about all those other tribes? Ephraim, Manasseh, and so on? Well, they're out there, and you can just come to a logical conclusion about where they are by looking for the nations today that are doing what seems right in their own eyes. Every man doing what seems right. The rule of law, in other words, is attacked, stamped out, buried at every turn, and you're left with this. This thinking, these ideas, these principles, rather than the principles that form the foundation of Magna Carta, of the U.S. Constitution, going back to that Paul Johnson quote, the essence of the rule of law is its impersonality, omnipotence, and ubiquity. It's the same law for everyone, everywhere, kings, emperors, high priests, the state itself, are subject to it. If exceptions are made, the rule of law begins to collapse. That was the grand lesson of antiquity. That's the grand lesson of history. Exceptions are being made at every turn, and we see the rule of law in our societies collapsing. In that same article, Mr. Johnson says, speaking of the U.S., thus took shape the economic dynamo that eventually became the United States, an experiment designed to establish the rule of God on earth. That's a noble goal that these founders had, establishing the rule of God on earth. Do you think the Ten Commandments were important to those founders? Of course. They knew that this experiment, as Mr. Johnson calls it, they knew it couldn't work without rule of law. That's why George Washington said the foundations of our national policy will be laid in the pure and immutable principles of private morality. What was he getting at there? What did he mean, the president, President Washington, when he said, of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports. What are you left with? When you take away the rule of law. These men knew enough to know that the experiment was doomed to fail. If you take away religion and morality, if you take away the rule of law that governs everyone's behavior, including kings, emperors, high priests, the state itself. John Adams, another one of the founders, he said, statesmen may plan and speculate for liberty, but it is religion and morality alone which can establish the principles upon which freedom can securely stand. We take freedom for granted. But, as was brought out at thetrumpet.com just today, visit the website and see the article that we posted there on the 800-year anniversary of the Magna Carta. Freedom isn't free, as it says in that article. Freedom is not free. You take away the principles upon which freedom stands, and you lose your freedoms. You lose your liberties. And you can use all kinds of euphemisms that sound nice, justice, equality, and so on. But look around. You see those freedoms evaporating. You see those liberties being taken away. You see the law of God. You see the law of the land trampled underfoot. On this 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta, and particularly given what's happening in our nations, there's a lot to think about, isn't there? There's a lot that you can certainly study. There's lots of material that we have that can help you in that regard. I've mentioned a couple of them today. America Under Attack. America Under Attack, our most popular booklet over the last 2 years. And you can see why, because people are looking at what's happening in America, and they're worried. They're concerned. Well, going right together with that one, No Freedom Without Law. It's interesting reading that booklet again, as I did this past weekend. No Freedom Without Law. The bulk of it was prepared back in 2000 after the constitutional crisis that the United States had revolving around a presidential election. And to see how many of those statements can be taken right from that booklet and applied to today, when it's much worse, 15 years on, much worse than it was in 2000. But everything that my father talked about in that booklet, put together originally in 2000, I mean, we see it playing out. We know where this is headed. So many of us live through it in the spiritual sense. We know what happens when the law is attacked and ridiculed and buried and trampled underfoot. Destruction sets in. And so on this 800-year anniversary of the Magna Carta, go to God and pray for a greater appreciation of law and government. Thank God for His law. Thank God for His Ten Commandments. And look forward to the day when that law of love will be administered on this earth by the family of God. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show on KPCG 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma, and the live stream at kpcg.fm. Send us your feedback at td@kpcg.fm. As always, thank you for listening today, and we'll see you again tomorrow.